you can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff, Hans Feeney, Scott Klusendorf, Craig Parton, Will Wheaton, Angus Manoogian, and Jonathan Fisk at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Collinsville is 15 miles east of St. Louis. Early bird registration is $110. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois.
Tonight, I call upon all of us to set aside our differences, to seek out common ground, and to summon the unity we need to deliver for the people. This is really the key. These are the people we were elected to serve.
That's President Donald Trump speaking during last night's State of the Union address. I watched it in part, and I was struck by how positive, how upbeat the State of the Union address was. I was also struck by the contrast between what I'm kind of calling State of the Union President Trump and Twitter President Trump. They seem to be sometimes two different people. How do we reconcile those two things? And maybe with a little more of State of the Union President Trump, he might have a few more supporters and a few less detractors. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to talk about the president's State of the Union address. Joining us to do so, Molly Hemingway, a Fox News contributor, a regular guest and senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's great to be here with you.
And Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome to you.
Glad to be back.
Molly, you called President Trump's State of the Union a big picture speech. What do you mean by that?
Well, usually State of the Unions follow a very predictable path. It's a laundry list of policy items with money thrown here or there, but not so much a big picture. We're getting at overarching issues, and I was just very pleasantly surprised. I hate State of the Union speeches. Like, I can't stand them, and that's whether they're politicians I like or dislike. But this was a really big concept speech about what it means to be American, about government being accountable to the people it purports to represent, about fixing serious problems, dealing with what it means to be a country. You know, there was a lot dealing with immigration, and it wove in stories of Americans in a way that undergirded the policy notions or these conceptual notions. So it was just a much different speech that we saw under Ronald Reagan, a real change in how State of the Unions were given. He was the first guy to do one of those things where you cite an American citizen. And in his case, he brought out the federal employee who had jumped into the freezing Potomac to save people's lives when a plane crashed on the 14th Street Bridge. And that's what got all these vignettes starting. And then these speeches have kind of been the same ever since then. Well, this still had those vignettes, but it was just a really sort of reimagining of what the State of the Union would be, less focused on policy and more focused on the ideals that undergird the nation.
What did you think of it, Mark?
Well, I largely agree with Molly's big picture assessment. I would say, though, that, you know, in terms of State of the Union speeches, it still had its sort of laundry list component, and which was, for the most part, well chosen in terms of the items and the legislative priorities that Trump chose to address. At the same time, it was also sort of like frustratingly incomplete in the sense that, like, I was sort of shocked and amazed to hear a president actually address civil service reform and the need to be able to fire federal workers. I mean, entire cabinet agencies in the federal government that employ, you know, tens of thousands of people go entire years without firing a single federal employee for cause. And you mean to tell me that, you know, there aren't bad federal employees out there? No, of course, there are plenty of bad federal employees out there. They're just impossible to fire given the nature of federal unions and things like that. So this is a very big systematic issue. Everyone who actually, you know, knows, lives in Washington and deals with the federal government knows it's a huge issue, knows it's an issue that needs to be addressed if you want to get any sort of systematic reform. But at the same time, you know, whenever you deal with government unions, you're sort of walking into a minefield. So it was like very, you know, amazing to hear of a president who had the sort of, you know, gumption to mention this issue. But at the same time, you know, civil service reform is a very complex issue, and Trump just sort of picked up the issue and dropped it. And he did that on a lot of things. So, you know, on one hand, it's good to have a president that's finally addressing and saying things, you know, that need to be said. I just wish that there was more of a follow-through from the White House. Maybe we'll see that in the coming days on some of these issues, or, you know, maybe this is just, you know, signaling. I mean, insofar as it's signaling a president that's more aware of the problems of the quote-unquote swamp than most. So that's good. And then there are some of the policy proposals that are just sort of typical Washington stuff, too, like Trump's $1.5 trillion infrastructure proposal. Trump's a builder. He's a developer. This is an issue that's near and dear to his heart, and you can tell in the way he talks about it, like he's very excited about this. However, infrastructure bills, they tend to attract the worst aspects of Washington legislation in terms of, you know, congressmen signing up to get pork for their districts, and whenever the government does anything involving that kind of central planning that infrastructure entails, it tends not to work out very well. At the same time, you know, there's a perfectly rational argument in a lot of ways for various infrastructure projects that the federal government should be involved in, and because the way they facilitate economic growth and other things like that. So what you really need is you need a very smart, detailed plan on infrastructure. You can't just say, hey, I want you to go out and spend $1.5 trillion without really extensive follow-up, because otherwise that tends to, you know, produce, you know, really, really bad results. So I don't know. I mean, you know, it was a wonderful speech in a lot of ways. I totally agree with what Molly said about the sort of the people that Trump brought to the speech, and the moral component to the speech was really refreshing. To have a president go out there and highlight a North Korean dissident, or the incredibly powerful way that he, you know, spoke to abortion with the cop that adopted the heroin addict's baby. And that's all good, and it was nice to be uplifted, but we really need details to follow through on the kind of moral leadership we saw from the speech.
Molly, another reason we have State of the Unions or modern State of the Union addresses so the president can kind of run down the list of accomplishments so far, and it's only been a year, but how did you evaluate the president's list of accomplishments?
Well, first off, one thing that I thought was notable was that he typically brags and speaks about what a great person he is. And this speech, when he talked about accomplishments that have been made, he's much more likely to use the first person plural and talk about teamwork and whatnot. That was pleasant. You know, a lot of people don't like that braggadocious aspect of Donald Trump, and he really toned that down. A year ago, when he gave a joint address to Congress, it was unique because, unlike most presidents who begin their presidency, Trump faced serious, dramatic, almost hyperbolic opposition from the get-go. And what you saw in the course of the first year was that resistance continuing to be very strong. That's resistance meaning the political activists, typical Democratic activists, the media, and even a lot of people in his own party. So at the end of the year, after facing that kind of unprecedented resistance and refusal to accept even the legitimacy of his presidency, he had a great year. It surprised everybody. Then with this massive corporate tax reform, there had been these accomplishments in terms of dramatic deregulation, the kind of which has never been seen before. It's like smart deregulation that helps businesses have the confidence that they can invest and not have to hold a bunch of money for compliance dealing with regulation. It also made global companies think about the attractiveness of the U.S. market in terms of basing their companies here. There were the judicial appointments. There was the nice change of affairs with regard to ISIS, the crushing of ISIS, by allowing the U.S. military to be held accountable for their own strategy and not have to run everything through the White House. There were so many accomplishments, and there was this subtext of, if that's what could happen after a year, if after a year he's staying strong, he has the entire Republican Party supporting him, and yes, there's a softening of support among the independents who helped give him that power, but if he's still standing after everything that was thrown at him, that list of accomplishments suggested a sort of unification of people who are not part of the resistance, people who just want to continue to see success in foreign policy, economic policy, and otherwise.
Mark, you were talking about the projected spending for things like infrastructure. President Trump comes from a business background. You often hear in that context you have to spend money to make money. Can this be equally applied to the federal government spending money?
Well, that's a really good question, and it speaks to what I was saying. Is, you know, obviously the federal government has a vital role to play in big-time infrastructure projects. I mean, you know, the national highway system is probably something that the federal government should be involved in, you know, both as an economic issue and as a national security issue even. So, you know, we have to, but the issue is, how does the government go about doing these things? What we saw, for instance, with the stimulus bill that Barack Obama passed, again, remember, that was supposed to build $1 trillion worth of infrastructure, essentially, you know, all these shovel-ready projects, you know, that supposedly existed. Well, if you actually look at what that stimulus bill did, it turned out to be, you know, a gigantic giveaway to Democratic special interests. And they included all sorts of stipulations and riders that were basically giveaways to labor unions, for instance. So all of the construction projects and stuff like that, you know, had massively inflated costs because they were, you know, shoveling that money off to, you know, labor unions, which, you know, give billions of dollars to Democratic campaigns over the last, you know, decade. So there's a lot of smart infrastructure projects, I think, that could be done, you know, in both in terms of things that we don't typically think of. Like, there's a strong case being made that the federal government should be involved in expanding broadband to rural areas that where it doesn't exist already in the U.S., because that having broadband in places would facilitate, you know, all kinds of economic development in rural areas that where it currently seems impossible. So that would be, like, one smart thing. And then the other thing is simply, well, if you do have to build roads and airports and all the traditional infrastructure projects, you know, you need to think about how the federal government goes about doing that in terms of private partnerships and other things like that, so that taxpayers get the most bang for their buck and that they're done as quickly and efficiently as possible, which is actually something that was refreshing to hear that Trump spoke to specifically in the speech. You know, he talked a lot about the permitting process, you know, about how the Empire State Building was built in a, you know, a year or two, 100 years ago, and the idea of constructing, of finishing a project that large in, you know, 21st century America is, you know, just beyond laughable with all of the red tape and, you know, legal issues and other things that we're currently dealing with. So, again, it's just a thing where, you know, you want to see some meat on the bones before we talk about spending, you know, $1.5 trillion we don't have at a time when we're, you know, we have a $20 trillion deficit.
Mark Hemingway is our guest. He's senior writer for the Weekly Standard, along with Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. We're talking about President Trump's State of the Union address. There is theater involved as well, and part of that theater, unintentional perhaps, was the Democrats, or at least most of the Democrats, complete lack of reaction. Did it do them any favors? We'll find out after this.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the language of medicine and law today. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. At gruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at adcruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Listening to God's Word, daily prayers, frequent and faithful reception of the Eucharist, confession of sins and absolution, good works. Learn more about the life of Lutheran piety in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January. Thank, praise, serve, and obey. Recover the joys of piety. It's written by regular guest Pastor Will Whedon. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call 1-800-325-3040. Thank, praise, serve, and obey. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about President Trump's State of the Union address. Mark Hemingway is our guest, senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, part of this is political theater, and there's enough of that from the way these things are coordinated with the vignettes you were talking about before. But another part of the theater was the lack of reaction on the part of many of the Democrats who were there in the chamber listening to this speech. They not only did not applaud, they sat as still as possible, as far as I could tell. Were the Democrats doing themselves any favors by reacting or not reacting this way?
Well, I think it kind of remains to be seen whether that was a good idea or a bad idea. I think they could have accomplished much of the same, if not been even harsher, by politely applauding a little bit, but not standing up. You know, when everyone else is standing up and cheering patriotism or the flag or having a nation that understands borders, I mean, you know, just to politely applaud sort of respectfully, but not show disdain, that might have been, in a sense, more powerful, because it would show them being reasonable, but still opposing based on some principle of some kind. I thought about this also by talking to some parents who had let their kids watch this. And even Mark and I had talked about this a bit. We tend not to let our children see a lot of presidential rhetoric right now, sadly, because we don't want our children to adopt the insults or, you know, gratuitous insults or bad words that you might pick up from our current president. And this was a speech that for a lot of people was their children's first introduction to the president. They thought that this might be a safe enough thing. And there was a lot of nice rhetoric there. And so for that to be the first introduction, not just of hearing President Trump speak, but also seeing what the opposition to him looks like, I kind of think about it through the eyes of a child and how a child perceives someone sitting on their hands when other people are shouting USA. And what, you know, so those optics might not have been so helpful to Democrats. I thought their response, the State of the Union response, you know, it was kind of sad they had to drag out yet another iteration of a Kennedy, but that was a nice, fresh-faced young man who presented a nicer image of the Democratic Party.
So, Mark, one thing that was observed by Robert George this morning, I believe, after having seen the State of the Union, was, and he marvels, he is not a Trump supporter, but he marvels at the president's ability to kind of make his opponents make themselves look bad. Was some of that going on there?
I think there was some of that. I mean, it was weird watching the coverage on television because, I mean, I thought it was a generally good speech that would appeal to independents because it, you know, spoke directly to American values that we should all, you know, theoretically agree on. But with, you know, Democrats sitting on their hands when Trump does things like proudly announce that we have the lowest African-American employment in recorded history or whatever it was, I mean, you have to wonder what their motivations are at some point. And on top of that, there were all these sort of, like, this morning, if you look, there were all these sort of damning clips. There was this amazing footage of Joe Manchin, who is the moderate senator from Democratic Senate or from West Virginia, who like starts to get up very enthusiastically in response to what Trump said, and he like looks around and realizes no other Democrats are getting up, and then he like quickly, you know, sits back down. And look, if your brand is a centrist Democrat and you're trying to get elected in districts where, you know, the Nancy Pelosi wing of the party, the San Francisco liberal wing of the party, seems to be driving much of the agenda, and trying to convince them that you can be a Democrat and still represent more moderate districts, you know, the optics of last night just look really bad, because, you know, what you saw there with Joe Manchin was him looking around and saying, you know, oh, my man, Chuck Schumer is going to be really mad at me if I stand up right now. You know, I don't think that they did themselves a lot of favors. I mean, I do think that it affected the media coverage insofar as, you know, people in the room, you know, were sensitive to the fact that Democrats were upset, and then the journalists picked up on that. But, you know, people watching it at home were probably scratching their heads, you know, at a lot of, you know, the Democratic refusal to acknowledge sort of benign sentiments that we should all be happy about. But, you know, and at the same time, you know, Democrats have shown with this government shutdown and things like that, that they don't have a very good competing narrative for some of the things that Trump's trying to do in immigration and other things like that. So they're not at the same time offering a competing vision that they're, you know, standing behind, so that looks like, you know, that they're the firm opposition. You know, they just are being obstructionists for obstructionist's sake. Certainly Republicans did their share of that under the Obama administration, and when I think that they were at their most obstructionist, Republicans paid a price for it, and I now wonder if Democrats aren't edging into that same territory where, you know, the obstructionism is going to come back to hurt them with independent voters.
Molly, one of the surprise vignettes last night, I think it was a surprise, was the defector from North Korea who came replete with crutches to wave in the air. What did you make of that? What was the message being sent in that element of the State of the Union?
Well, I think it wasn't just him, but also the Otto Warmbier's parents who were there and talking about their son who was tortured and essentially killed in North Korea. There is a big conflict between North Korea and the United States. It hopefully won't lead to out-and-out war, but it's important for people to be clear. You'd seen people were upset that Donald Trump had used some extreme rhetoric against Kim Jong-un and the North Korean regime. And I think this was a way of reminding people that this really is a country that has serious human rights abuses and is not to be trusted as being an entity that has legitimate authority over its people who are oppressed and in a very bad situation. That was an incredibly powerful moment, seeing this man lift his crutches above his head. All the other stories involved people who are U.S. citizens. And this man is a citizen of South Korea. He escaped from North Korea and he's in South Korea. But there was something so American about that, too, this idea that the fight for freedom can be eternal and there's dignity in the human across all these things. That was a really nice vignette to see. Some people interpreted it as bellicose, that this was a way of Donald Trump further trying to go to war against North Korea. I mean, clearly there is a problem. North Korea has nuclear capabilities that our U.S. policy has been opposed to and failed to effectively fight for many, many administrations, going back to the Clinton administration, if not before.
I just wanted to add, though, that there was a very powerful moment precisely because it reminded, you know, I think a lot of people that we have completely forgotten the lessons of the Cold War, which we managed to basically win without firing a shot, which was that we took every available opportunity for decades to assert our moral superiority and delegitimize the regime from within on a national and world stage, to call out communists as being, you know, yes, an evil empire, to go out there and say, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And you have to remember, when Reagan did those things, Washington insiders were screaming bloody murder that you could not do this because it would, you know, escalate tensions and things like that. Well, it turned out in retrospect that it was the exact right thing to do. And, you know, we need more reminders of that, you know, particularly because, you know, during the time of the Cold War when the counterculture left was rising, just as there's this sort of, you know, resurgence of the extreme left now, there's a lot of people that are, you know, denigrating U.S. cultural values. And we need to remind people that our values are still remain, you know, and our democratic values in particular still remain vastly superior to so many alternatives, and that, you know, so many places around the world are just really horrifically authoritarian and abusive. And, you know, when you remind people that fact, the U.S. doesn't look so bad, and it also makes the priority of resolving these, you know, places, the situations where there are places where there are horrifically abused political prisoners and things like that, you know, a much bigger priority on an international stage.
A final question for both of you. Molly first. I was watching the speech and thinking, if this was the Donald Trump I got on a regular basis, I could much more readily be a supporter. Talk about, if you were, your thoughts here finally about the disparity between State of the Union Trump and Twitter Trump. Molly.
Well, it really is. I mean, you've just made the whole point that I think frustrates so many people. This speech, which was authentically Trump, it sounded like him. It was delivered very easily. It was clearly in his language, and it was clearly his thoughts. It was like the best version of his thoughts that we've seen over the course of the last few years. And there was virtue in what he said. What is frustrating for so many people is this intemperate inability to control one's rhetoric or to just have some discipline in how to deal with opponents that you see much of the rest of the week when he's not doing a scripted event like this. Part of that is his appeal. One of the things I think has been challenging for him is he has these instincts, these impulses to be different than a traditional politician. Well, he was different than a traditional politician last night, but it was still good. Whereas a lot of when he goes off script, it's, you know, it reminds you of why politicians shouldn't be too out of the accepted norms of political rhetoric. So this, I think it was good. But he also had a really good speech last year, though. And he had a good speech at Davos, although it was maybe a bit too much on the traditional side and not enough on the authentically Trump side a week or so ago. So the fact that he got such a good reception here is important, I think, for seeing future behavior. And also the fact that so many people saw him and probably saw him in a different light. You know, millions of people watch this, and they saw him in a different light than he's presented through the mediated site that we see frequently on national TV and whatnot.
Mark, same question for you with about 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, I agree largely with what Molly said. I mean, there's a lot of people that, you know, want to support Trump and the things he's doing. They just say things like, you know, gosh, I wish you wouldn't tweet as much. But I did notice that there was, you know, it was like Molly said, it was very authentically Trumpian, but there were some very subtle shifts. You know, as Molly pointed out, there was the more inclusive use of words like we and things like that. If you look at the guests, the State of the Union, there clearly was a conspicuous attempt to highlight the fact that, you know, minorities were benefiting from his administration, and, you know, he wants to be known that, you know, he is president of all people, and he's there to help out all people. You know, he didn't tweet anything intemperate this morning, you know, so someone in the White House didn't want him to step on a good news cycle. So I think what we might be seeing is hopefully John Kelly and some other people in the White House has gotten through to him that a little more discipline can go a long way toward, you know, helping him get things done.
You can read Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
And Mark Hemingway is senior writer for The Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you.
Thanks again.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series Introducing the Books of the Bible, talking with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller about, well, we've been through Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. We are moving on to the fourth book of the Bible, the book of Numbers, which the title doesn't tell you anything about what you're going to find in there. But what you do find is the ongoing story of God's people as they are at Sinai, as they are beginning to live out this covenant that God has made with them. We'll talk about that with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller tomorrow. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
You can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff, Hans Feeney, Scott Klusendorf, Craig Parton, Will Whedon, Angus Manoogue, and Jonathan Fisk at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Collinsville is 15 miles east of St. Louis. Early bird registration is $110. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois.